Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. My name is Jackie Morris. I'm the Clerk Assistant Procedure. And before we kick off, I would like to pay my respects to the Aboriginal traditional owners of this land, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and to the elders past and present of Australia's Indigenous peoples. Ben Wellings is a senior lecturer in politics and international relations in the School of Social Sciences at Monash University. He's no stranger to Canberra. He was here from 2004 to 2013 as the convener of European Studies at the ANU. In 2012, he published his book English Nationalism and Euroscepticism, in which he wrestled with the slippery notion of English nationalism and its more concrete manifestation in resistance to European integration. Fast forward to 2016, so it was a prescient work, Euroscepticism became much more concrete with the referendum of 23 of June in favour of the UK leaving the European Union. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ben Wellings to speak on the topic of taking back control, Parliament's sovereignty and Brexit.
Thank you, Jackie, and thank you all for coming and being here. And perhaps I can just do a few quick extra thank yous here. Tony, Philia, who is up the back, I think, and but also maybe Josh and Eloise, two former ANU students who apparently have some hand in me being here. So thank you to them as well. Like Jackie said, it's been interesting times, as the apocryphal Chinese proverb has it. Whatever I may think of Brexit, I can certainly say it's been good for business. Plenty of food for thought and for discussions like these. And when we were thinking late last year about what might actually say and talk about in this particular occasional lecture, the idea came about that something about parliaments would be appropriate and interesting, of course, you know, being where we are. And it got me thinking really about sovereignty, of course, which is you know, an enormous concept when it comes to Euroscepticism and Britain's place in the European Union. But I was particularly impressed, if you like, or scared, depending on how you look at it, when I went over to do some research in the immediate aftermath of Brexit. And it struck me that I couldn't really tell who was in charge. In that sort of time after the Brexit vote had happened, David Cameron had stepped down, Theresa May was not yet Prime Minister, and we were going through sort of the various kind of backstabbings and underhand tactics that meant that neither Gove nor Boris Johnson nor Andrea Leadsom would actually be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. I felt like that apocryphal Martian who might have arrived in London in July 2016 and said, take me to your leader. And of course, someone would say, well, I'm sorry, I don't really know who that is at the moment. But it wasn't just questions of leadership. It was also questions of which corporate body, if you like, was in charge. Was the government in charge of the United Kingdom? Was Parliament in charge of the United Kingdom? Were the people in charge of the United Kingdom? So what I want to say in this lecture is that Brexit opened up an awful lot of opportunity, if you like, for various different bodies to take back control. Right? You're probably familiar with the slogan that was the Leave campaign's really quite ingenious three-word slogan, take back control, that could be read on all sorts of different levels. On one hand, it was about taking back control of local communities from foreigners, from immigrants. On another hand, it was also read as a constitutional argument about taking back control from Brussels. But in the wake of the vote, there were all sorts of grey areas that opened up, in which allowed various different parliaments, not just the Westminster Parliament, I'm going to be coming to that in a while, not just the Westminster Parliament, but various different parliaments to take back control from each other. So what I want to say is, first of all, that Brexit is not just the referendum vote of June 2016, but it's the politics of nationalist mobilisation leading up to that vote, and it's also the politics of disengagement subsequent to that vote. Right? So that's when I talk about Brexit, I'm talking about an extended period in the first three quarters of this this decade, if not slightly longer. And it also opened up questions about sovereignty. Are we talking about post-sovereignty? Are we talking about good old-fashioned sovereignty? And where might these different understandings of sovereignty pertain within the United Kingdom itself? So what I will be speaking about in the next 40 minutes or so is to talk about the place of referendums in the United Kingdom. Importantly, quite different to Australian understandings of referendums and how they come about. How that links to popular sovereignty, which also has quite a peculiar place in British political theory, and a slightly newer, though not unheard of, phenomenon in British politics, populism. And of course, we know that there is a kind of a populist moment happening around the world. Brexit is in part an expression, a peculiar expression of that in the United Kingdom. But I also am importantly going to break down the United Kingdom into its constituent components, because that is a really, really important element in understanding Brexit and the politics thereafter. So first of all, I want to talk about the government's understanding of sovereignty and what I'm calling the new English unionism. And I should say at the outset here that unionism in British political terminology is not the same as unionism here. It's not about trade unions. It is about supporting the union of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And in particular, the really important relationship there is between Scotland and England. Okay, so I want to say something about the place of England in this moment of Brexit. And then I'm going to talk about the devolved administrations, Scotland, Wales and London. Scotland is the most salient and important of these particular instances because it has the greatest autonomy from Westminster. And then say something about sovereignty, Brexit, and the northern the border between the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland in Northern Ireland. So we know, of course, that the United Kingdom does have a land border with the EU. It's with the Republic of Ireland, and I suspect you'll be no strangers to some of the politics that are happening there. But also, questions of sovereignty really pertain in that part of the United Kingdom as well. And then lastly, I want to focus on Parliament itself, and I should say, in some ways, I'm reflecting my kind of old English biases there. I really mean Westminster, okay, because there are many parliaments in the United Kingdom now. That fact hasn't always percolated down or up, depending on your point of view, to Westminster and to the English. But nevertheless, Westminster is still in an important position in the United Kingdom, and I want to refer to it as the squeezed middle. Right, for reasons that I will explain as we go on. So this, then, is where we are at. You'll probably remember this particular distribution of support for Leave and Remain. The yellow is Leave from the referendum of 2016. I beg your pardon, is Remain from the referendum of 2016, and the blue is Leave. And the central map, I think, brings out really starkly the kind of national differences that the Brexit referendum itself of 2016 threw into light. And the thing that stands out there most obviously is Scotland. You know, it's an actual, not just a political, you know, it's not just a map of voting preferences, it's actually a map of Scotland as well. You know, that neatly mapped onto each other. You can see that Northern Ireland is divided. The fact that Northern Ireland is divided will come as no surprise to many of you, and that cleavage fell very closely along sectarian lines. And you can see that the picture is a little bit more problematic and dispersed when you get into England and Wales, but the fact is that England outside of London is really predominantly for Leave. Now, this alerts us to the fact that that Brexit was an important element of Brexit. And I'm trying to sort of add something here to this idea of Brexit as a revolt of those left behind by globalisation. Important element of this was actually national differences, all right? The kind of nationalist mobilisation that had taken place up to and before the actual vote itself. And what we want to say about this then is that in the two decades before the Brexit vote, there had been a process of embedding devolved administrations throughout the United Kingdom. Right, so of course, Scotland, Wales, London, Northern Ireland, more recently in some northwestern regions of the United Kingdom. But what we're dealing with here is not a federal structure. I think that's an important point of comparison to make out if we're thinking about this comparatively. We're not dealing with a federation, we're dealing with an asymmetrically devolved state. Right, you might call it a kind of a quasi-federation, which is also removing itself from another quasi-federation, the European Union. Right, and so these different moving parts, if you like, open up a lot of grey areas. And I had a legal scholar colleague once told me that if you can't exploit the grey areas, then you're not a good lawyer. And I think that's true in politics as well. You know, you need to be able to exploit those grey areas. And that is what Brexit has done. It has, I think, illuminated the grey areas is probably an oxymoron. It has deepened these divisions and opened up some areas to exploit. So this is where each of these different areas seeks to take back control, not just from the EU, but from each other too. So let me say something about referendums, popular sovereignty and populism in the United Kingdom. And I'll get to Mr. Farage's quote in a moment. So since 1997, referendums have become a feature of British politics, all right, especially when associated with constitutional reform. So there's the first thing to note. Until recently, referendums were not common in British politics. They have appeared with increasing frequency, if you like, since 1997, when New Labour came in, part of what Chris Gifford calls New Labour's strategy of governing populism. And we've seen them endorse the decision to establish a parliament in Scotland or re-establish the parliament in Scotland and an assembly in Wales in 1997. We've seen a further referendum in Wales in 2011. There was one associated, of course, in 1998, I beg your pardon, with the Good Friday Agreement in Ireland and the Northern Ireland. There was a referendum in the northeast of England on whether there should be a regional assembly in 2004. There was one, of course, the Scottish independence referendum in 2014, and then the EU referendum itself of 2016. So you can see that perhaps something has changed in the nature of British politics in that we see this increasing recourse to the device of a referendum. Oftentimes, they're used in that particular period as a de facto endorsement of decisions that have already been made. Okay, so in particular, devolution to Scotland and Wales was supposed to be was a decision that had already been made by the new Labour government, but a referendum was deployed to give it like extra legitimacy. Okay, and that's an important unintended consequence is that now referendums are in some ways a kind of a bulwark against the re-extension or the reclamation of powers of Westminster in these devolved areas. And also something else to note is when referendums didn't happen. Okay, so in amongst all those dates of the last 20 years that I gave you, were the non-referendum on joining the euro, the United Kingdom's joining the euro in 2003, and the referendum that the United Kingdom didn't have in 2005 on the draft constitutional treaty of the European Union because the French and Dutch had already rejected it. Right, so the point there is that sometimes just threatening to have a referendum is enough to derail a particular course of political action, because the implied notion was that the public was so Eurosceptic that they would just reject these ideas anyway. And we might sort of say, well, that's probably well-founded. However, all this political activity around referendums masks the fact that such a device was a novelty in British politics. Now, I'm talking about UK-wide politics here, because there are local instances of referendums that have taken place even since the 19th century. So establishing public libraries was one that you would have local referendums on in the 19th century. In 1946, a town called Stevenage in Hertfordshire had a referendum where they said that we do not want a new town for people from London built next to us, right? So they voted to reject the notion of Stevenage New Town in 1946. In Wales in 1961, there was a referendum on whether to ban drinking or not. Okay, and some areas voted to ban drinking and some areas voted not to ban drinking. So for a while in Wales, you had a kind of a dry state and a non-dry state. And you can imagine how that went down in certain households. And then there was a so-called Northern Ireland border poll in 1973, which was supposed to endorse the border of Northern Ireland, but it was boycotted by the nationalist community. So you can also see that questions of participation are important here. And, of course, and I'll get to this in a little while, the first referendum for all of the United Kingdom was in 1975 on whether to remain a member of the common market, as it was then known. Now, the outcome of the Stevenage poll in 1946, the new town was built anyway, gives you some sense of the principal problem of referendums in British politics. Referendums in British politics can only technically ever be advisory if you believe and uphold the principle of parliamentary sovereignty. The principle of parliamentary sovereignty says that no parliament can bind its successor. There is no higher authority than Parliament in the United Kingdom. And you can see how joining the European Union is going to problematise that particular understanding of sovereignty. And so, in a way, when the 1975 referendum took place, it actually opened up an alternative source of authority in British politics that was not Parliament, right? It was the people. Now, I know that might sort of sound strange in a democracy, and of course, there's, you know, elections have an inbuilt kind of sense of populism in them. But there was a very strong strand in British government that was a kind of a mixture of Tory paternalism, Labour welfare statism, and a kind of a Sir Humphrey government, steering from Whitehall, that came up with the overall. Some of which was that government knows best, was the way it was expressed. That basically, the United Kingdom existed under what Lord Hailsham once called an elective dictatorship. That is to say, every 4 or 5 years, the electorate would vote enormous powers to the executive government via Parliament. And the executive government would rule until the next set of election came around. So we're getting building in some subtle differences here to the Australian situation, where, you know, sovereignty. There is, of course, a notion of sovereignty built into Section 128, where if you want to change the constitution, you have to have a referendum. The difference here, of course, is that referendums in the United Kingdom are not triggered by constitutional change automatically. It's a political decision, right? So the more closer an analogy between Australian referendums and United Kingdom referendums would be last year's postal ballot. Okay, so what happens is that a party loses control of an issue, and that issue is then presented to the electorate as a matter of either conscience or supreme national importance, which must be decided by the people, who are suddenly constituted as a source of authority above that of the politicians and the executive government. When in 1975 Harold Wilson decided to implement a referendum on Britain's membership of the common market, he actually borrowed heavily from Australian practice. Okay, one of the things he didn't do was he felt that computers were not necessary at this stage to count the votes, so he decided to abjure that. They were still counted by hand at that particular stage. But a lot of the policy exchange was still coming from Australia in that particular case. But the reason it got to a referendum in that particular instance was because the Labour Party, which was governing and was the main Eurosceptic party in 1975, was so irrevocably split on this, both within the cabinet and between leadership and the rank and file, that the pro, or at least agnostically European leadership said, OK, let's put this to the people. Now, when that happened, there was a 2-1 vote in favour of staying in the EU. The common market, as it then was. But from the perspective of sovereignty and popular sovereignty, the cat is out of the bag, right? So it set up a precedent that actually the people need to be consulted on an issue of importance, an important constitutional matter such as this. And we see the Labour Party, when it comes back to power in 1997, pick up this theme of referendums as an endorsement of constitutional change. But I'm going to fast forward now to the Conservative, or at least the coalition, as it was, government of 2010 to 15, which also started to build in this necessity for a referendum in order to increase the powers of the European Union, or at least its competences within British politics. And this is something called the EU Act of 2011, which builds in what was called at the time a referendum lock. That is to say that if the European Union wanted to increase its competences over any country, but, you know, it would apply to all countries, but in particular the United Kingdom, that the United Kingdom was obliged to have a referendum on this. Okay, now that potentially meant a lot of referendums. So there was still an idea that it would be a political decision to decide what actually represented a fundamental transfer of competency, but nevertheless, it was now building in this notion of popular sovereignty into the British political system, which had not been there before. And as Emma Vines and myself were tried to make this case when analysing the EU Act of 2011, this had the unintended consequence of undermining that which it sought to protect. Right? So the idea was is that you would use a referendum to protect the sovereignty of Westminster against further competencies of the European Union extended over the United Kingdom. But what it did was actually open up an alternative source of authority or sovereignty by building the people and the referendum device into the British political system itself. Now, that was a way to, an attempt at least to manage the growing rise of popular discontent that was aimed both at the British political class and at the European Union in the years after 2010, particularly after the global financial crisis and the parliamentary expenses scandal of 2009. So this kind of revolt, this kind of populist revolt, is exemplified, of course, by the UK Independence Party and Nigel Farage. And in his speech the European Parliament, 2 days after, or sorry, one, 5 days after the referendum in June 2016, he really pulled out the kind of the populist element here. You can read these quotes. I'm sure you have done already. But the part I'll pull out was that, you know, he says that what happened last Thursday was a remarkable result. What the little people did, what the ordinary people did, the people who've been oppressed over the last few years. He was really pitting the people against not only the European Union, but also the pro-European political class in the United Kingdom. And this shifts then from notions of popular sovereignty to populism. Okay, the populism is slightly different in as much as it suggests that there, I'm drawing on Kasmuda's work here, but basically conflict in society is that between a pure people who are expressive of the general will and all kind of virtuous values in the political community, and an elite that have been corrupted. They've been corrupted by their proximity to power, either in a direct sense, in sort of lining their own pockets, or they've been corrupted indirectly through too much proximity to vested interests that are beyond the reach of democratic control. So populism, of course, is a slightly difficult ideology, if we want to call it. It's not necessarily formed up as an ideology, as in a very formed up and thought about way. It is, if you like, a kind of an expression of resentment, and but it does have quite close links with democracy and nationalism and nationhood. In the United Kingdom context, it's opened up this question: well, if the people are sovereign, which people exactly are we talking about? If you seek to express a general will through a referendum device, it assumes that you know who or what the political community is, or indeed that one exists. And Brexit started to show that that was not necessarily something that could be taken for granted. Now, this shifts us on to the government's position and what I'm going to call for now, but will problematise and come back to later, as the new English unionism. Now, I've suggested before that the politics of nationalist mobilisation has complicated this understanding of a single political community. So when Theresa May said in the wake of Brexit that we voted to leave the United Kingdom as a single United Kingdom, and we will leave the United... we voted to leave the European Union as a single United Kingdom, and therefore we will leave the European Union as a single United Kingdom, she's making a claim there. In a way, that claim is an attempt to take back control from other parts of the kingdom which are seeking their own autonomy. And in particular, she had Scotland in mind when she said this. And I think it was very interesting, again, you know, watching this play out on the 13th of July 2016, when Theresa May came back from Buckingham Palace, having accepted the Queen's invitation, another source of sovereignty in the United Kingdom, to form a government. The first thing she did, other than thank David Cameron for being a terrific Prime Minister, was defend the Union. She didn't highlight immediately leaving the European Union. What was a greater priority to her, if we take the way her speech was constructed as an indication, was the United Kingdom. She says, not everybody knows this. Sounds like Michael Caine doing that, doesn't she? She says, not everybody knows this, but the full title of my party is the Conservative and Unionist Party. And that word unionist is very important to me. She continued, it means we believe in the union, the precious, precious bond between England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. But it means something else that is just as important. It means we believe in a union not just between the nations of the United Kingdom, but between all of our citizens, every one of us, whoever we are and wherever we're from. Now, of course, so what she's trying to do there is talk not just about the political union of the United Kingdom, but the social divisions that have been opened up by the distribution of votes for Remain and Leave across the United Kingdom, but especially in England, and making a claim to sort of take back control over some kind of redistributive policy, which seems not to have taken place. But the point is that when Theresa May told voters that the United Kingdom was precious to her, this was a Southern English Conservative Prime Minister defending Britishness. Right. So this is one version of what I've called elsewhere English nationalism. If we start to disentangle England from Britain, an elite version of English nationalism is characterised by the desire to defend British sovereignty. Right? This is where the kind of the conflation between England and Britain starts to take place. And in this point of view, Brexit involved a three-level game, right? Not only getting the UK out of the EU, one level, and seeking alternative or traditional allies outside of the EU, the second level, but also keeping the United Kingdom united while all that was going on. That's the third level. So there are three things going on there. But within England, the Conservatives, who until 2017 were very much the kind of the English party by name, by deed, if not by name, were now playing a double game with England. England was crucial to understanding the vote to leave, but it was also crucial if the Conservatives were to keep the United Kingdom united. Because if the English stop believing in the United Kingdom, then there is going to be trouble, as we shall see. But this UK government perspective, which by virtue of its support within the Conservative Party becomes de facto English, is actually a very English conception of United Kingdom sovereignty as singular and unified. Okay, that Westminster could, if it wished to, rescind the devolved administrations in Scotland, Wales, in the same way as it has done in Northern Ireland, although, of course, for very different reasons. Now, I'm not saying that would be very provocative and inflammatory, and it may, of course, although it's technically possible, it may be politically impossible. But nevertheless, that idea of sovereignty, of the Westminster Parliament's sovereignty, of the executive government's sovereignty, still remains. Now, you can imagine how that kind of understanding of sovereignty is received in Edinburgh and Cardiff. It sets alarm bells ringing and was predictably resisted by the devolved administrations, both the Scottish National Party administration under Nicola Sturgeon, but also the Welsh Labour administration operating in Cardiff. And the reasons that there is this disjuncture here is because the notion of the British Constitution, right? Now, remember, I'm not talking about a written document here. I'm talking about a kind of an accepted ways of doing things, sometimes characterised as a customary constitution, has been steadily challenged by changes in Scotland and Wales since devolution in 1999 and the way that has bedded down. This change has not been well understood or recognised in Westminster or Whitehall, I would say. So what we've got here are different and competing understandings of sovereignty that are operating within the United Kingdom as Britain comes out of the EU. So in Scotland, these differing conceptions of popular sovereignty have existed actually for a long time. And in reverse order, there have been so-called claims of right made on behalf of or by the Scottish people, both in 1989, after the imposition of the poll tax, in 1842, which was to do with problems in the Scottish Kirk, and even in 1689, about the after the revolution of 1688. But as I said, this reality has gone little noticed in Westminster or Whitehall, even Downing Street, but it is a strong way of understanding sovereignty in Scotland. So, for example, a good expression of this is when the Scottish Parliament opened in 1999, the Speaker of the Scottish House, Winnie Ewing, made the point that this was a reconvening of the Scottish Parliament, which had not met since 1707. So if you think that, you know, Australian parliamentarians don't meet often enough, you know, sort of three centuries is even further. But the point she's making, this was a reconvening of the Scottish Parliament. It had gone into abeyance since 1707, and now it was back. So what was seen as a constitutional innovation from London, from Edinburgh, was seen as a restitution. So, of course, the Scots had their own independence referendum of 2014, which was another way of saying taking back control. I mean, in this instance, taking back control from Westminster, even if the idea was is that you would retain it within the European, retain a measure of oversight from Brussels within the European Union. However, the fact that the English majority at Westminster agreed that a referendum should take place and whatever the result was, that the result should be respected, seemed to suggest that the United Kingdom was now a voluntary union, all right? That this idea that that it was unitary had somehow broken down. I mean, the Catalan option, if I can call it that, was technically possible, that the London could have done what Madrid did and just declare it as illegal and ignore it. But it didn't. And then that sort of fits into notions of British British politics and incrementalism. But even with that, the idea that Scotland was somehow different did not enter into the official mind very strongly in Theresa May's government. And Theresa May's method and means of getting the UK out of the EU is just a reassertion of the government's control over Scotland. So both Scotland and Wales, in their different ways, the Scotland Act of 2016 reasserted that the devolved parliament cannot be rescinded without recourse to a referendum in Scotland. Right? The Wales Act of 2017 mimicked the Scotland Act in stating that the Assembly or Senate could not be rescinded without a referendum. So here again we've got the sovereignty of the Welsh and Scottish people, which is now a bulwark against the extension of executive control over the United Kingdom. And of course we are waiting for IndyRef 2, the possibility that there would be another referendum on independence in Scotland as and when the terms of the Brexit deal are announced. I mean, that is up in the balance, and I don't know that that will be an easy thing for the Scottish National Party to win, despite the very pro-EU vote that we saw in 2016. And lastly, a quick word about London. London, of course, is very connected to the European Union. This might be an apocryphal story, but they do say that London is France's seventh most populous city, just because of the number of French people who've subsequently moved to London to work in that sector. The London administration is very unfavourably disposed towards Brexit, but it doesn't have the strength and the autonomy that the Scottish Parliament itself has. So this leads us then to perhaps the most difficult and contentious part of Brexit and the kind of shared sovereignty, if you like, that that operates. The border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which is to say the border between the United Kingdom and the European Union, or the land border between those two countries, is the hardest square to circle in the Brexit negotiations. And this is partly because there is a fear that reimposing a physical border on the island of Ireland will reignite the troubles. You know, the Good Friday Agreement, we just had the 20th anniversary of those last week, brought a kind of an uneasy truce there, and it seemed to have bedded down. But we know that the government of Northern Ireland has not been able to sit for the last few months, and Westminster actually has applying direct rule in Northern Ireland as we speak. And the difficulty comes in the negotiations is because back in December, it was agreed that there would be no restitution of a hard border in Northern Ireland as part of the Brexit deal. On the other hand, it was also stated that Britain would not be part of the single market. And those two things at the moment seem to be contradictory, right? So the question is, well, what happens to Northern Ireland? Where, in fact, will the border of the United Kingdom start and stop? What side of the Irish Channel, the Irish Sea, will we find the United Kingdom border? Because if Northern Ireland remains within the single market or even the customs union, or a customs union, that means that effectively the Northern Ireland is not as much a part of the United Kingdom as it once was. So this is the hard part. But here we've got all sorts of like overlapping sovereignties. Right? This is not just a question of the United Kingdom and Westminster dealing with a devolved assembly. To some extent, the Republic of Ireland has a say in the governance of Northern Ireland. Also, the European Union, of course, used to have a lot of say in the governance of Northern Ireland. All those things are part of the grey areas that are coming apart as the Brexit negotiations pull out. Now, of course, you might not be surprised to learn that the British government is not keen on their losing Northern Ireland. Right. Although the constitutional position in the Good Friday Agreement was that if there is a referendum in favour of Northern Ireland leaving the United Kingdom, you know, presumably to join the Republic of Ireland, but I'm not sure how keen the Republic of Ireland would really be about that. Nevertheless, that is the point. But the British government's position is that it will not lose Northern Ireland. So Theresa May pledged on the 29th of March, so this was 1 year in after the triggering of Article 50, with another year to go, pledged to defend the integrity of the United Kingdom, which she described as the world's most successful union. Okay, she said, there's no way we're going to break that up. So they did a poll. YouGov, along with LBC, did a poll saying, you know, okay, everyone, what would you rather do? Would you rather leave the European Union or would you rather retain the Northern Ireland in the United Kingdom? And when you look at it overall, the overall vote was that most people in Britain would prefer to leave the EU than keep Northern Ireland in the UK. Right? When you look at Conservative voters or voters who claim they have voted Conservative in 2017, 61% of Conservative voters said they would rather leave the EU than retain Northern Ireland. When you look at people who said that they voted for leaving the EU in 2016, 71% of Leave voters said they would rather leave the EU than retain the United Kingdom. Now, the headline of this was that, you know, looking at this was that the majority of Brits would rather leave the EU than the UK. But again, we have to infer here, and polling companies and social scientists are not great at asking the question of England at the moment. So we infer. So then we look at Scots there, we find that actually more Scots want to keep Northern Ireland in the UK than leave the EU. So what this is a British response. Sorry, this is an English response. Okay, so I'm returning now to the importance of England. You know, we've looked at all the devolved administrations, but I'm returning to the importance of England. England is crucial in what happens in Brexit. And I want to then, for that reason, sort of say, well, okay, actually, the idea of a new English unionism isn't quite right. Okay, so the kind of language that Theresa May is using is a form of unionism that seems to have its roots and wellsprings in England, in particularly in southern England. But actually what we see is the strength of unionism, if we take this, I mean, I know we're not supposed to pay any attention to polls, but it's too tempting. If we take this as some kind of evidence that the strength of being British is weakening, the strength that underpins that union that Theresa May says is so precious to her is actually degrading. And what we find is that actually, although we think of Euroscepticism as a British phenomenon, it's actually an English phenomenon, by and large. And that is, so when you start doing the kind of polling where you ask people what nationality they think they are and then link it to their attitudes towards European integration, most people who self-identify as British are pro-EU, and most people who identify as English are anti-EU. All right, so I'm coming back to this idea of England as crucial to this. And the last thing I'm going to say before I get to the concluding slides is about Westminster as the squeezed middle. And one of the, you know, the great left behinds of the Brexit vote was actually the Westminster Parliament, you know, because what happened to them was that they had been, if you like, sidelined by the popular sovereignty and populism implicit in the vote and the referendum device. And at the same time, in the wake of that, they had also, or Parliament had also been sidelined by the executive government's desire to take back control from various administrations and its interpretation of the popular vote as giving it a mandate to get out of the EU without having to seek recourse to Parliament. Now, of course, this was challenged. Various MPs, David Lammy from Tottenham, a Labour MP, was particularly vocal in this, saying, look, the referendum is only an advisory thing, you know, his belief in the principle of parliamentary sovereignty. Referendum is only really advisory. Parliament's got to have a vote now on whether we do really get out or not. Now, that might be technically correct, but as I've said before, it's politically inflammatory, and it wasn't able to do it. There was a challenge, of course, put into the High and Supreme Court, and the High Court initially voted that Parliament should have a say on Brexit. So originally, the government wanted to use the royal prerogative. That's the thing that they use to declare war on other states. So when we think about what's happening in, or might be happening in, Syria soon, that is to do with the use of royal prerogative. They were going to use those powers to get out. So the High Court decided that that wasn't compatible with the British Constitution. And for their troubles, they were therefore labelled enemies of the people by the Daily Mail. Daily Mail, of course, is not an elected body. No one voted for the editorial board of the Daily Mail. But this is like using this as an indication of the kind of the populism and the way Parliament was squeezed between populism and executive authority. Now, of course, they have, or it has, got the right to have a so-called meaningful vote on Brexit. It's not clear how meaningful that vote can be once the Brexit deal is known in October. There won't really be enough time if Parliament rejects it. And we've got to remember, before the vote, Parliament was pro-staying in the EU. Not really clear how much time Parliament will have to, or how much authority really Parliament can bring to bear on the negotiations, which are like a large, you know, ship coming into port and needs a long time to stop or turn around. But nevertheless, there is a kind of a measure of voice has been given to Parliament here. But I think Parliament has been, or Westminster, I should say, has been one of the great left behinds of the whole Brexit episode. So I'm going to conclude now by saying three things, right? So firstly, just a claim about why it's important to approach it, this question of sovereignty and Brexit from this point of view. The clear differentiation between nations in the vote to leave the European Union created challenges for the asymmetrically devolved nature of the European Union. And so Brexit, therefore, as the politics both before and after it, opened up contestation with what is still called British politics, still actually EU-UK politics. In some ways, we might be better off thinking of this as sort of like Anglo-British, Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish politics, precisely because the UK is not a federal polity but a devolved one, where, you know, notionally Westminster could take back, rescind the powers of the devolved assemblies, though that would create a constitutional crisis of its own. So if we understand Brexit as not just narrowly the referendum on the EU in 2016, or Britain's membership of the EU in 2016, but we think of it as an ongoing politics of nationalist mobilisation before and after the referendum, it represents a moment where key actors sought to take back control, right, not just from the European Union, but from each other too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ben. We've got about 10 minutes or so for some questions. I think you'll agree with me that it was really a very interesting talk, and at some points you've thrown a really long historical lens across some of the things we're seeing at the moment, so I enjoyed it, and I'm sure everyone else did. Have we got any bids for questions in the audience? We've got mics on the side, if people don't mind Oh, no, they'll come to you. Look at that. There's a gentleman up the back, and then we'll come to you, sir. I think you're good.
Okay, great. So when David Cameron won the election, he took to the people the policy that he would give them a vote on leaving the EU. And all the polls showed leading into that election that it was going to be very close. A lot of polls showed that Labor was going to win. And then he won this absolutely thumping majority, didn't need the Liberal Democrats. And he sat there and thought, well, it must be my good charm and my accent and so on. And then took to the people this idea that he would let them leave the EU and was shocked when it happened. It just seemed to me there's just a complete misreading of the electorate, including by the Prime Minister, and then he had to fall on his sword. It just seemed to me extraordinary that even he couldn't see the fact that he won the election might have been primarily due to his Brexit policy.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think you're exactly right to highlight how difficult it was to think forward even a couple of years in politics, you know, at that moment in time. And, you know, of course, we've got all sorts of other elections, not least here or in the United States, that seem to have a similar pattern. And I think one of the things was there was a lot of de-alignment taking place or had taken place. I'll talk about the United Kingdom here specifically. And the UK Independence Party was an important part of that. And it was really forcing the Conservative Party to think about, you know, like, how are they going to see off this threat? And the referendum pledge was an example of how to do that. And, of course, when he made that pledge in 2013, it seemed like quite a remote possibility. And for the reasons that you've said, you know, winning with that majority and then him wanting to sort of get it out of the road because, you know, early in the next term of his government, all pointed to the fact that it seemed to be like it was going to be another one of those sort of post facto endorsements of some settled policy, and it turned out not to be. And I think that you're right, there was all sorts of misreading from politicians, academics, pollsters. There have been parliamentary inquiries in Britain as to why the polls were so inaccurate, and there was an awful lot of misreading going on, and I think that the disalignment... And the kind of disillusion with politics was you know, making that weather system hard to read, if you want to use that analogy. But you're absolutely right.
There's a gentleman down the front here, Philia, if you.
Yeah. My questions. I've got two questions, but they're related to one another. A lot of the coverage we get here in Australia about Brexit is, you know, fairly superficial stuff these days, and it's about the argument about whether it should be a hard exit or a soft exit, etc. My questions are, what is the general population in all parts of the UK? Are they tuned into this debate, or have they now moved on and leave the others to argue about it? And then that leads into my second question, where do you think the UK will be in 10 years' time? Do you think we're creating, you know, earth tremors now that may end up as an earthquake and split, or will it all just move on and people just get back to their ordinary lives?
Right, OK. Predictions. First of all, I think it's very hard to talk about the United Kingdom electorate or populace in general anymore. If we think about the electorates, I'll keep it at the political rather than the social level. I think it's difficult to talk about that as a unitary body. So even last year's general election, which was seen as the most British in the fact that we saw a return to kind of like 82% of voters voting for the two main parties, and the votes distributed, you know, throughout. Well, basically, it means in Scotland. Basically, it means that the Conservatives won in some seats in Scotland again. Despite that, I think that Brexit is understood differently in different parts of the United Kingdom. And now, I'm thinking of the political classes there as much as the electorate. So if I sort of think about your question about, you know, is the electorate engaged, I'm not sure. I think a lot of people thought that when Britain or the United Kingdom voted to leave the EU on the 23rd of June, that it would leave on the 24th of June. Right, so if I was looking at petitions to Parliament just the other day, and so one of the petitions was like, "We need to get out of the EU now," because that sentiment was not well understood. You know, I mean, that's sort of one of the problems about referendums, isn't it, is that issues aren't very well understood. So I think there's some sort of frustration at the negotiation stage and why, you know, like David Davis keeps going to Brussels and all this sort of stuff. I mean, in Northern Ireland, the debate is quite different and the engagement is quite different to, say, Southern England, right? Where will the United Kingdom be in 10 years from now? This is being recorded, isn't it? So,
you did very well in 2012.
Well, you know, it'll. I'll start off with a safe prediction. It'll still be off the coast of France, and then there's this question about well, will it have left, and will it be any different? You know, like so. The idea is that, you know, say one of the Labour Party's pledges is that when Britain gets out, the government has to ensure that it is in exactly the same position. Or its citizens are in exactly the same position as when it was in. And that's clearly, to me, an unrealistic proposition. You can't leave a club and have the same rules, right? So I think that materially it's going to be worse off. I'm going to bring in the Anglosphere here as a, you know, this was sort of one of the off-the-peg winners of Brexit, actually, was that when no one had any idea of what to do, three of the cabinet that Theresa May appointed were supporters of so-called Anglosphere, and the idea was that, you know, Britain would trade with places like Australia, and of course Australia would love to trade more with the United Kingdom, and Canada would too. They said so yesterday. But the idea that getting goods from Australia or Canada is going to replace the EU, it won't work. You know, even a free trade deal with the United States, if depending on how the president's feeling, you know, when he wakes up. Or never goes to sleep, because he doesn't seem to go to sleep, does he? But I think it will be materially worse off 10 years from now than it is now. It won't be part of the European Union. That sounds like an obvious thing, but that people have been saying, well, it might be. But I think it will find itself more isolated than it has been.
Stormont will start assuming or wanting more powers because they've seen your English nationalism show more and, you know, being put in front of them?
Yeah, I think Northern Ireland will have more to do with the Republic of Ireland and therefore the EU. I think Scotland will continue on its trajectory, which seems to be the fundamental idea of Scottish nationalism, is just like more autonomy, slightly short of independence. And I think Wales will continue to be more or less in step with England. The question is England. England has no government of its own. Westminster has direct rule over England. And I think that I think one change is that more English people will simply say that's not good enough. But I'm not sure that regional assemblies will be the answer. I think the governance of the United Kingdom will be very lopsided. I can say that 10 years from now.
We've got a chance for one more, Rebecca? Yep.
Thank you. My question concerns the comments you made towards the end of your speech. You referred to the royal prerogative to go to war, and you referred to the possibility of war against Syria. My recollection is that before Tony Blair joined the invasion of Iraq, he sought parliamentary approval and obtained it. The first time David Cameron wanted to invade Syria, he sought parliamentary approval and he didn't obtain it. He then tried again a year or two later and did obtain it. Many then wrote that a convention had developed in the UK that the UK would not go to war without the approval of the Parliament. I gathered from your comment about the royal prerogative to go to war that you do not agree that there is such a convention. It's an issue that's obviously critical to the relationship between the executive and the parliament, and you'll know that there's been much debate in Australia that we shouldn't go to war without parliamentary approval. So I'd be interested in your views whether there is such a convention in the UK.
Yeah, thank you. That is a good point. And in August 2013, David Cameron, as you say, didn't get that approval. So that means that in February 2003, we got an approval. In August 2013, we didn't get an approval. 2015, we did. So it's only 2-1 in favour. And I think that the idea of the customary constitution, when does it become a convention? You know, I'm not sure. And I think that we have seen instances where the executive has overturned what has seemed to be enshrined in legislation. And so I'm thinking a slightly different example, but I think is pertinent, is the Fixed Term Parliaments Act. Right. So one of David Cameron's initial ways to kind of try and build in certainty into the British political cycle was to say, let's have a fixed term elections of 5 years. And of course, when the political opportunity came along for Theresa May to deliver what she thought was going to be a knockout blow to Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, that was simply overturned. And so I'm not convinced yet that any sort of convention has bedded down with regard to the royal prerogative and the declaration. Well, of course, it's not a declaration of war, it's just authorising military action. So if you want to, so strictly speaking, you know, it could be the case. But I just don't think it's happened enough yet to be a convention.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. It's been really interesting. And I think everyone, you can tell from the questions that people have enjoyed it immensely.
Well, thank you.